All right, go ahead and turn to your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 13 and put a finger there. And when you got that marked, if you don't already, turn back to Isaiah chapter 8. I want to begin the class tonight by reminding us of a couple verses in Isaiah 8, verses 9 and 10, where Isaiah says in Isaiah 8, 9 and 10, "Be broken, O peoples, and be shattered, and give ear, all remote places of the earth. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Devise a plan, but it will be thwarted. State a proposal, but it will not stand, for God is with us." Now, this was spoken as part of Isaiah's warning to both Israel and Syria that their plans to take down Judah was not going to work. And the reason why is that last phrase in verse 10, "God is with us." Instead, they would be the ones who were broken and shattered. But I want you to notice in verse 9 who needs to heed this message. In verse 9, the ones who need to heed this message are all remote places of the earth. Now, as we've mentioned before, Isaiah loves to drop hints about upcoming themes. And this statement in Isaiah 8 verse 9 is a tease to chapters 13 through 27, God's world vision of the Messianic kingdom. The idea is this: in chapter 6 through 12, it describes how God would ultimately save his people despite their sin and allow a remnant to escape the Assyrian flood, and that was ultimately going to be fulfilled through the branch of David on Mount Sinai. But what happened in chapter 6 through 12 was not a one-and-done situation. As we were reminded in chapter 10, God is sovereign. And that means the fate of Israel, Syria, and Assyria will be the fate of any and all nations that dare to pick a fight against Judah that is not according to God's sovereign will. That is the overall theme of Isaiah 13 through 27, taking the main points of chapter 6 through 12 and then broadening it to a much wider worldview to include other individual nations within Judah's sphere of influence. So, if these chapters are addressed to other nations, what might the nation of Judah get out of it? This: it would be foolish to trust in these nations for assistance against looming threats. And for two reasons. First, these nations up here, they're doomed. It's already sealed. And we're going to see that when we study these chapters. But secondly, after their judgment, when a remnant from these nations return, they're all going to be rallying to the one true God on Mount Zion. And so Zion doesn't need their help. They need Zion's help. And that's another prominent theme in these chapters 13 through 27. Now, chapters 13 through 27, as you can see in the outline, can be divided up into three different cycles and oracles. The first two cycles, 13 through 19 and 21 through 23, are given to specific nations, though four of the five cities in this second one are actually given enigmatic titles that were sort of veiled. But the third one is not really an oracle. These are more general and universal in nature. That first vertical column, that first set of oracles there in 13 through 19, declares the certainty that God holds the fates of the world in his hands and that his promises will be fulfilled. We can bank on it. Chapter 20, which is that sort of skinny line right there in between the two cycles of oracles, is actually an intermission that is designed to provide somewhat immediate grounds for trusting God's promises through Isaiah performing one of the very few signs that he's asked to perform in this book, sort of after the manner of Ezekiel, and we'll get to that here in a little bit. The second cycle, chapters 21 through 23, is a complete contrast from the first cycle in the sense that it reveals more uncertainty in the midst of a coming darkness in which the result can't really be determined. And so the idea would be that for those who pass the tests of faith from chapters 6 through 12, as well as chapters 13 through 19, this next cycle in 21 through 23, that's going to be a new challenge for them. When things seem really dark and uncertain, am I still going to trust God even then. And that's the idea of chapters 21 through 23. And then this third cycle right here, 24 through 27, is not specific to any one nation. It is a continuous literary unit that contrasts what is called the world city with God's city, Mount Zion. And it includes all the themes of the previous two cycles, but hones in on God's grand strategy. All right. Now, in chapters 6 through 12 that we just got done studying, God proved his faithfulness to his people in many different ways by expanding these points to a broader worldview. That means it would challenge those people who were in the present at that time who might have lacked faith, because if they can't come to see God's sovereign power with where they're right at right now in the midst of what's going on in chapters 6 through 12, with all the accompanying signs, all the accompanying prophecies that Isaiah is doing, how are they ever going to trust him in regards to these more obscure promises? All right, as we get into this section here, there's a few things that we want to try to keep our eye on. First of all, one of the common themes you're going to see when we study these oracles is that Isaiah will address the specific nation. It's obvious he's talking to a specific nation, but then he'll like change course in the middle of the oracle and basically say, now what I'm saying is about this nation, but this really applies to the entire world. And I'm going to try to point these out as we arrive to them. But as you read, pay attention for how it becomes very local, and then Isaiah expands it to a more worldview type situation. Most of these oracles are very straightforward. They're not very hard to understand. There are two or three that are really obscure and difficult to interpret. So there's going to be a lot of speculating when we get to these, a lot of reading between the lines. I'm going to do the best that I can to tell you what I think these things are talking about. But it will be very beneficial if you make sure you have these chapters read beforehand so that you can at least be familiar to them. Also, the way this chart is laid out, this is another Laura Silvernail goodie right here. The way this is laid out here is no coincidence, meaning obviously the vertical things have themes related to them. There are also themes going on horizontally, okay? I purposefully did not tell you what those themes are because you know what? Homework assignment, guys. As we're reading this and we're getting to these chapters, see if you can find common themes across the board. See if you can do it. It'll be really fun. You'll be able to do it. And you'll be like, man, that Isaiah, that Joker, he was something else. There's really a lot of great organization and strategy with the way that he laid these oracles out. I promise you, there are themes repeated horizontally. See if you can find what those are. When we get to the end of chapter 27, I'll lift the veil and I'll show you what they are. But you're going to be a lot better if you... Oh, hold on, Jenna. I'm just kidding. It'll be online too if you don't want to take a picture of it. So does that make sense? All right. Any thoughts on any of that? I know that's real introductory stuff. I hope you didn't get that. That's blackmail material right there, man. All right, then. All right. If history teaches us anything, it is when one superpower goes down, another one always rises to fill the void. Once Assyria goes down in 609 BC, Babylon is going to be that superpower, and they are going to be the first oracle. They're going to be the subjects to chapter 13 and 14. Now, Babylon would actually become a bigger threat than even Assyria, which is almost hard to believe. But what is so interesting about this is that when this oracle is written, Babylon is not even a superpower yet in Isaiah's day. Now, they're a significant nation, and they had been a thorn in the side of Assyria all the time that Assyria was rising to power. But God, who knows the end of all things, he knows exactly what Babylon is going to become. And so what Isaiah does that's so interesting is he skips right over their rise to power, assuming that they are going to be supreme one day. And then he focuses the entire oracle on their inevitable judgment. These two chapters have caused some confusion for Bible students because while it most definitely focuses on literal Babylon's future fall, Isaiah is going to go from speaking to literal Babylon to a more general worldview, as if to suggest that while Babylon is certainly the literal nation in mind, her ideologies are a figure of other nations and worldviews to come after Babylon. And we know that nations copied certain Babylonian ideologies, particularly its pagan practices. Or else, why would books like Revelation use Babylon in a very figurative sense? Like in Revelation 14, verse 8, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the great, she who has made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion of her immorality." And then in Revelation 17, verse 5, "And on her forehead a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth." And even Peter said in 1 Peter 5, verse 13, that he was writing his epistle from Babylon. But that's really strange, because at the time that Peter wrote his epistle and John wrote the book of Revelation, Babylon was nothing but a desert. So I would say it's likely that Peter is actually in Rome, which is what I believe that Revelation is probably referring to. So how then do we navigate these two chapters when it's obvious that literal Babylon is being referred to, but then at other times it sounds like he's talking about the entire world that would take on a Babylonian ideology? Well, one thing that might help us is, you know how when you're studying the seven churches of Revelation, and we look at these churches Ephesus, what was the problem with Ephesus? They lost their first love, right? Now, we recognize that there was a literal church called Ephesus that had lost its first love, but wouldn't that apply to all? Wouldn't there be other churches who would have the same problem as Ephesus in the future, and those would be churches that need to go and heed the message of what God tells Ephesus? That's what's going on in chapters 13 and 14. Don't get confused by the fact that he goes from a literal Babylon to a more world standpoint, because all he's saying is Babylon was a big problem, but there's going to be other nations that are going to follow right in its footsteps, and the same thing that's going to happen to Babylon is going to happen to those guys as well. Does that make sense? Any thoughts on any of that? I spent the first 12 minutes of the class doing an introduction and not even getting into chapter 13, so we're going to have to roll here, man. Any thoughts? Was that my subtle hint again not to raise your hand and ask a question? Go ahead, man.
Do you think maybe the fact that Babylon was the one that ended up taking Jerusalem, do you think that might have something to do with it too?
It could, yeah. Because Isaiah loves to drop hints. And so it very well could be that he's going ahead and dropping a hint about what he's going to be talking about in chapters 40 through 48, which is really going to focus on them in captivity 100 years down the road from when Isaiah actually writes it. So why not go ahead, skip over their rise to power, assume their judgment, just to sort of give them a little bit of taste of better things to come? I'm just speculating here, but that's so typical of Isaiah to do something like that. Any other thoughts?
So history repeats itself.
Pretty much, yeah, pretty much. And go to Nebuchadnezzar's statue and you see that same thing as well. Revelation is really not that unique when you think about it. A lot of the same things that happened that book talks about are things that already occurred in the Old Testament. We just have to learn to interpret it around that. So, okay. All right, so let's get into chapter 13. Isaiah 13, verse 1 says, "The oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz..." Saul. All right. I couldn't remember if it was road or Saul. All right. Oracle. Some of your translations will say burden. It's a heavy message of importance that is weighty in sorrow and in grief. What is the oracle to Babylon regarding? Verse 2. "Lift up a standard on the bare hill. Raise your voice to them. Wave the hand that they may enter the doors of the noble. I have commanded my consecrated ones. I have even called my mighty warriors, my proudly exulting ones, to execute my anger. A sound of tumult on the mountains, like that of many people, a sound of the uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts is mustering the army for battle. They are coming from a far country, from the farthest horizons, the Lord and his instruments of indignation to destroy the whole land." All right, now as we've already mentioned, Isaiah loves the signal imagery. Remember in Isaiah 5 and verse 26, he used it to call Assyria to judge Judah. And then in chapter 11, verse 10, he identified the root of Jesse as the one who would summon the remnant of the people back to Zion. Ancient armies communicated in that way. They would raise flags on hills and places that could be seen, hence the phrase Bear Hill. Distinct shouts could be heard when closer, and even hand gestures, that's more like a baseball coach probably. I imagine what would a military guy do? And it goes something like that. Hand gestures. They yeah, thank you, Larry. Some of these guys are in the military that know a little bit better than me. But that they had those kind of things going on. That would be for more like close distances. So though we don't find out who this is referring to, verses 2 through 5, until you get to verse 17, let's just go ahead and get it out there. The nation that God is summoning to conquer Babylon are going to be the Medes. And they are summoned by God to enter the houses and the gates of the nobles to overthrow them and to take possession of the city. Notice in verse 3, it says that they've been consecrated. Does that make you feel, you know, like you got the heebie-jeebies there? Consecrated. I mean, that sounds like a religious word there. And we're going to see that kind of language referred to in regards to Cyrus in chapter 45. But don't think of that in a religious sense. In fact, as you see there, God affirms that the Medes were very arrogant. But despite their arrogance, he's setting them apart to do his will. And that's the idea behind consecrated. And then in fact, in verse 5, he refers to them in the same way that he referred to Assyria in chapter 10, verse 5, the instrument of his indignation to destroy the whole land. So you see, what's happening here is just a repeat of history that's going on here. Same thing that Assyria was going to be used for against Israel and Assyria and also to Judah is what the Medes are going to do to Babylon. Is what Babylon's going to do to Jerusalem, and on and on and on we go until people learn their lesson. It's just like a broken record. All right, verse 6 through 8, wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, all hands will fall limp and every man's heart will melt. They will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. Now, that idea of wail means howling. The Oriental culture was a lot more expressive in their emotions than us Westerners are. The day of the Lord means fierce judgment, and it's near. We're going to talk more about what that means when we get to verse 9, so hold off on that for a second. But verse 7, look at that. It speaks of helplessness. Hands and hearts are symbols of personal action and reflection, both the outer and the inner, meaning Babylon won't be able to act. They're not going to be able to plan. The hands will hang down, weapons falling. They're going to be helpless to resist the enemy, and courage will vanish from their heart. They're just going to have no nerve left is the idea there. And then in verse 8, we learn that Babylon's citizens were shocked to learn their city had fallen. That phrase, faces aflame, it literally means that they were red-faced with embarrassment and shame and indecision. Anybody want to take a guess why they were so embarrassed that they got conquered by the Medes? Anybody know why? Did the Medes come in and do this 3-, 4-, 5-year-long siege and bust down their walls? No, they didn't. Babylon thought they were so impregnable, they would have laughed at any army coming to try to besiege them. You know what Cyrus did is he actually diverted the Euphrates away from the city. See, the Euphrates fed the moats that surrounded the city of Babylon, went into the city, went out of it. Cyrus, miles up, diverted the Euphrates so that the depth of the Euphrates sank, the moats around the gates sank, and at night they just snuck under the gates and just killed the king, killed most of the nobility that was in the city. The commoners didn't even know that Babylon had been taken over by the Medo-Persian Empire for like 2 or 3 weeks. So that's why they're embarrassed. Babylon the Great, the impregnable city, nobody's going to take us down. Oh, God can help people find a way if he wants. Yeah, they're red-faced, all right. The day of the Lord. Why does something like this happen? Look in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. I think this is a good verse to go along with this idea. Somebody read for me 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 2 and 3. Raise your hand if you would, if you got it. Not everybody at once. Go ahead, Jason.
For you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them, as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape.
And according to Daniel 5, what were the Babylonians doing the night before they got invaded?
Partying
it up like rock stars, yeah. I mean, peace and safety. They thought, ah, nuts. Even though Daniel is there telling them, you know, the writing's on the wall. I mean, he's telling them. But yeah, that's what the day of the Lord is like. It comes when you don't think it's going to come. It comes when you least expect it. And that's what happened to them. That's why they're red-faced and embarrassed. Any thoughts on that before we go on? I'm going to tell you more about the day of the Lord here as we move on.
Well,
Okay, let's look at the day of the Lord. Verse 9 and 10. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger, to make the land a desolation, and he will exterminate its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises, and the moon will not shed its light. Now, verse 10 and 11 is language that is often used to describe, verses 9 and 10 is often language used to describe the day of the Lord. Now, what does all that mean? I mean, one thing that helps us when you think about the day of the Lord is don't think about it as a when. Think about it as a what. Because this verse is quoted by Jesus in Matthew 24, verse 49, and he's quoting it about Jerusalem. So this is not one specific event. It's not a when. It is a what. And there are a few possible interpretations. It could be as simple as the fact that judgments of this caliber make it seem like the whole world is falling apart. You ever felt like that when you're going through a rough time? Man, my whole world's falling apart. It could be as simple as that. It could be a poetic way of saying that even creation itself responds mournfully to God's judgments. In fact, we see this language in Romans chapter 8, verse 20, when we're told that the entire creation is subjected to futility and that it groans and suffers eagerly awaiting the day. So it could be that. Or it could be a denial to sinners of the benefits creation brings for having corrupted it. I mean, evil loves darkness, so this may just be God's way of saying, hey, you want darkness? Here it is, right here. But let me give you a fourth thing, and I think this might be the one that I think all of this could be right. But here's the thing that I think about the most, decreation. I think that could be the likely interpretation, God dismantling creation itself. Think about it. In Genesis chapter 1, God turned on the light, right? And now what he's saying is, I'm flipping the switch. Genesis 1, he said, let there be light. And then the Lord talked about populating the earth. But now in decreation, everything is becoming dark and the Lord is depopulating the earth. It's becoming desolate and an unpopulated land. That is exactly the opposite of what God intended for creation. So, I mean, evil always flourishes in the dark, but God is light. And all those celestial objects that are being referred to, they are merely reflections of his light. So when God withdraws his blessing from the world, it would be appropriate for the lights to go out, metaphorically speaking. So I think that's probably what is being referred to here. Does anybody have any other thoughts or ideas about what it could be talking about? You could be right unless you're wrong. Sometimes Isaiah uses mixed metaphors. Sometimes they can not just mean one thing, sometimes, but several things. That's the depth of Hebrew poetry. So, any thoughts? Okay, let's keep going. Verse 11 and 12 says, thus I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. All right, this is the first time in the oracle that the reason for judgment is mentioned. Just like with Judah and Israel that we saw in chapter 6 through 12, sinners have corrupted the land. They need to be exterminated. But notice in verse 11, what we've already talked about, the prophecy goes beyond just Babylon. And he says, I will punish the whole world for its evil. See how he's going from literal Babylon to more global in scope? Babylon symbolizes nations that are motivated by pride and a desire to conquer and destroy. So it's not just physical Babylon that's under consideration here. This would be against any nation that would dare to adopt a Babylonian worldview, as many nations in the future would, as is evident for Revelation's use of it as a figure and a metaphor. Verse 12 indicates that where man was once abundant, he will now be scarce. This again points to a remnant, men being much rarer than a region known for its finest gold, which means that an awfully high price that is more costly than gold is going to have to be paid to redeem these people. Hint, hint. Let's move on to verse 13. He says, "Therefore I will make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place at the fury of the Lord of hosts in the day of his burning anger." And so, similar to what we saw in that powerful throne scene in Isaiah 6, remember in verse 4 where it talked about God's presence, it was causing the whole foundation of the temple to shake. In the same way here, the forces of nature are depicted as being in an upheaval due to the coming judgment. It's cosmic, it's worldwide. All the order that was brought forth from creation is going to be undone in judgment. God is sovereign over all things, including heaven and earth, and humanity's sin, unfortunately, has cosmic implications. In verse 14, he says, "And it will be that like a hunted gazelle, or like sheep with none to gather them, they will each turn to his own people, and each one flee to his own land." Now, gazelles are shy, and they're fleet of foot when there's danger. Sheep are timid, easily dispersed without the shepherd, right? And so Babylon has found out, and all at once, that they've made God their enemy, and that they've lost him as their shepherd. Now, Babylon was made up of a lot of different people, and surely at its height, men would generally look out for its own. But now, as they're fleeing judgment, guess what? It's every man for himself. Get out of my way. I'm getting out of here faster than you are, right? Because if that arrow is going to hit somebody, it's going to be the guy who's behind me as I'm running, right? That's the idea. Verse 15, "Anyone who is found," though, this means you're not going to escape anyway, even if you do that. "Anyone who is found will be thrust through, and anyone who is captured will fall by the sword. Their little ones also will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be made plundered, and their wives ravished." They gained an enemy, they lost a shepherd, and now they find there's no escape. And anybody who manages to escape is going to be caught and killed by the sword. This is a very sad result of war. Men becoming heartless and void of compassion. You know, homes are supposed to be places of safety, but now those who are stuck in their homes or are trying to find safety in their home, they're going to find it plundered, and they're going to find that their loved ones are destroyed without mercy. You know, there's only so much loot that a soldier can carry. Pretty soon, only blood is going to satisfy him. This is brutal language of ancient warfare, and while it sounds cruel, you need to know that Babylon had the reputation of doing those very things to other nations. And this is a reap what you sow kind of text. And there was no Geneva Convention in the ancient world. And that's why you see the brutality. Y'all want to take a break for the fire, so from the fire hose? Got any comments or questions about anything before we get into verse 17? Yes, ma'am, Adrian.
In verse 16, it made me think of that, the Psalm 137, where the psalmist says, talking about Babylon, "Blessed shall he be who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rock." And that's how, you know, the Jews felt about Babylon after they had done that to them. And they pray for that to happen, God says.
Yep.
Hundreds of years, or 100 years, whatever, before that does happen.
Yes, very imprecatory, isn't it? Just like those psalms. Yeah, very much so. There are several psalms that talk about language in that terms that can be very difficult for believers sometimes to swallow. So, yeah, Mark?
What strikes me is the anger of God in all of this. You look in verse 9, "The day of the Lord comes cruel with wrath and fierce anger." Verse 13, "His burning anger." There's no middle ground here. The Lord is really upset with Babylon and what it has done.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, it's not, he's not asking to repent. This is a commencement of judgment on them.
Yeah. This is why it's tough to read these passages sometimes, because we're inundated of talks about God's love. And we should be, because God is God of love. It's just unfortunate that we give an unbalanced representation of him. He's also a God of wrath, isn't he? And this is judgment. And whatever you might think about judgment, as we've already said in Psalm 19, verse 9, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. That means they are right, even if it gives us an uneasy feeling. If we have an uneasy feeling about that, it's because we're sinners, and we need to make the adjustment and not God, right?
There's nowhere to hide.
Yep. They tried to in those crags and rocks back in chapter 2 and 3, didn't they? Yep. God can find you there, too. He's the best at hide and seek, that's for sure. Yes, sir.
Remember, God destroyed the world once with a flood. He promised, I won't do that again. This is not a flood. Mm. He's using the nations to destroy each other. But, like it said, there'll be so few men left that, you know, there's more precious gold than there will be humans left.
Yeah.
He is abundantly taking control to rid the world of the robust sin one more time.
Yeah. Isn't it ironic, though, that he uses the word flood to describe the Assyrian invasion in chapter 8? Yep. It's almost like he's winking while he says that. Interesting to think about. So.
But even though he has this side to him, we need him to be that way, because if not, he's not a just God. And you alluded to that just a moment ago. Mm-hmm. But we have to have a God who executes justice and does it in a righteous way. Otherwise, his authority does not really stand. Because we have to have both sides. We have to have the loving God that rewards those who obey him, but we also have to have the God of Isaiah 13 that renders his punishment and his discipline to those who disobey him. So we've got to have that justice, and he's willing to execute it if we are willing to disobey him.
Yeah, and since we're made in the image of God, we understand that sense of justice and fairness. We want it in our own lives, and so certainly we should recognize the source of where that comes from. Yeah.
Well, if we didn't recognize God being a God of wrath, then part of what man needs is a little fear to make him respect. Mm-hmm. Then why would we think we should serve God? We're all going to go to heaven anyway.
Right.
No. He's saying right here, you obey me or you suffer.
Yeah.
And he's proven that he is a just God one more time for the world to see, and wrote it down for us.
Yeah. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Yeah. Yeah, let's move on to verse 17. It says in verse 17, this is where he's going to reveal who he's actually talking about as the invading army. Behold, I'm going to stir up the Medes against them, who will not value silver or take pleasure in gold, and their bows will mow down the young men. They will not even have compassion on the fruit of the womb, nor will their eye pity children. So this is the army that God was calling in chapter 13. Verses 2 through 5, it's the Medes, what is now central Iran. Cyrus defeated the Median army in 549 BC, and then he united them with the Persians. That's why we call it the Medo-Persian Empire. And when they took Babylon in 539 BC, the citizens actually received him as a liberator. It took them 2 or 3 weeks to figure out, but they were actually very thankful, because the Medo-Persian Empire was less oppressive than the Babylonian Empire. The city, the buildings were left intact, but it was just a Babylonian political and military machine that were finished. And the great cruelty in which they showed Babylon, it was personal. It was all about revenge for some things that had happened before that we'll get into later. And that's why they could not be paid off. The Median army would have no compassion, no mercy, equaling, if not surpassing, the ruthless cruelty and heartlessness of the Babylonians. And their young, who were supposed to be the future, they would be slaughtered by those Median bows that were their most reputable weapons. In verse 19, it says, in Babylon, the beauty of kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew the Sodom and Gomorrah. What beauty of Babylon! That same thing that Nebuchadnezzar would have seen in Daniel 4, verse 29, when it says he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. He would have seen that golden palace and the huge walls which surrounded the city. Archaeologists say they were 387 feet high, 85 feet wide. They were so wide that four chariots could be driven side by side on top of them all the way around the city. The city was a perfect square, 15 miles on each side. It was the most powerful city of antiquity. It boasted wide streets, tons of buildings. It held 1.2 million inhabitants. It was protected by a deep, wide moat filled with water, as we've already said, by the mighty Euphrates River, which flowed into one side and out the other. It was so well watered and filled with gardens and farmlands and palm groves and orchards that, according to historians, it actually provided enough food for the city to last a 20-year siege, is what they said. I mean, that's ridiculous. And in the city, there were gigantic shrines that were created to deities, but that was not to be eclipsed by these marvelous air-conditioned hanging gardens, which Nebuchadnezzar had built for his wife for a birthday present. That's what Nebuchadnezzar is seeing in Daniel 4, verse 29, when he said, "Is this not Babylon the Great, which I myself has built as a royal residence by the might of my power and by the glory of my majesty?" And God said, "Uh-uh," to use the New American Ryan translation of Daniel 4. Though this destruction did not come, this complete destruction did not come about until 539 BC, when Cyrus conquered it. 20 years later, what we don't often talk about, in 519 BC, King Darius Hystaspes destroyed all of Babylon except 50 cubits of its walls, and it continued to get chipped away until in 60 BC, a historian by the name of Strabo said that it was nothing but a desert at that point. The reference to Sodom and Gomorrah, there you go. And I would say that doesn't just suggest complete destruction, but it also suggests moral calls, as we know from Genesis 19. In verse 20 through 22, it says, "It will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation, nor will the Arab pitch his tent there, nor will shepherds make their flocks lie down there, but desert creatures will lie down there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches also will live there, and shaggy goats will frolic there. Hyenas will howl in their fortified towers, and jackals in their luxurious palaces. Her fateful time also will soon come, and her days will not be prolonged." And to this day, Babylon has never been rebuilt. Even the Arabs, for some reason, will not pitch their tents there. Those are actual pictures of where Babylon used to be. Not even shepherds will use it for a pasturing place. Can there be a better image of desolation than what we just read in verses 20 through 22? And every civilization at some time is going to have to face their insufficiency, or every civilization is going to meet their same end. We don't know what all these animals are. They may be different in your translation. All that is to say is that these would be wild creatures who dwelled in dark places, and that is to show how this magnificent city eventually just went completely downhill to become what he describes there in 20 through 22. All right, I've only got like 3 minutes, and I want to get through the first two verses of chapter 14, because I think these two verses make a great segue between the two chapters. Babylon's destruction, as tough as it sounds, would be good news for God's people. In verse 1, it says, "When the Lord will have compassion on Jacob and again choose Israel and settle them in their own land." In other words, since Babylon was Israel's greatest enemy, any judgment on them was an expression of mercy toward God's people. And this will be the same judgment against anyone that will try to prevent God from bringing redemption to those people who would rally to his cause. He says, "Then strangers will join them and attach themselves to the house of Jacob. The peoples will take them along and bring them to their place." So the promise of restoration from captivity, this is a precious promise, one we're going to get into in chapters 40 through 48. And Gentiles during that time were actually inspired to join the winning team, both in an immediate way and certainly in a long-term future. In the immediate, we read in Esther chapter 8, verse 17, that when Mordecai was promoted to second in charge in the land of Persia, then he assigned that edict for the Jews to be able to defend themselves. We read there that many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. So that would be the short-term fulfillment of this. But we also remember from Exodus chapter 12, verse 38, that as the Israel's exodus began, we read in Exodus 12, verse 38, that a mixed multitude went up with them. But long term, I think we'd all agree that that has messianic implications, that second Exodus that we read about in chapter 11. And then it says, and the house of Israel will possess them as an inheritance in the land of the Lord as male servants and female servants, and they will take their captors captive and will rule over their oppressors. This is troubling for some Bible students because of the slavery connotations, but it need not be. He's just simply saying the role of captor and captive will be reversed. Israel will no longer be dependent on the nations. The nations will be dependent on her. But this subjection is not carnal, it is spiritual. It is the same as we saw in chapter 2, verse 3, in which the nations will come to Zion to be taught of her ways. The gospel will capture the Gentiles. It's what Jesus said in Matthew 5, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. How do the nations become servants to Zion? Stay tuned in chapter 60 through 62. It's going to talk a little bit more about that. But we know that in the New Testament, many Gentiles ended up serving the Jews. And we'll get into that a little bit later. Read chapter 14 for next week, for Sunday. I'm not going to be here, where you're going to have a guest teacher. And I'm just so excited for it that I'm not even going to tell you who it is. I'm just going to let you figure it out. He's going to be great. You're going to love it. Chapter 14, and then I'll be back in a week from the day. So, thanks, guys.